The widening wealth gap, the root causes of income inequality, and possible solutions. A new report by Oxfam is getting a lot of attention, especially one big statistic from that report. It shows that the 8 richest men in the world, just 8 people, own the same wealth as half of the population of the planet, 3.6 billion people. Measuring wealth is one way to gauge income inequality. There are many other measures as well that show the gap between the super rich and the poor widening, especially here in the U.S. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the root causes of income inequality and some possible solutions with the author of the new book, Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing the Wealth Home, and Committing for the Common Good. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There is a vast divide between the haves and the have-nots. We see it here in Maine, and we certainly saw it play out as a big issue in the presidential election. Income inequality is a core problem in American society, with the wealthy reaping their advantages and the poor more and more stuck in the cycle of poverty. What can be done to bridge this divide? Can the rich become part of the solution? With me in our studio, Robin Merrill. She is the executive director of Maine Equal Justice Partners. And on the line from WGBH in Boston, Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. And he's the author of the new book, Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing for the Common Good. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you know any examples of solutions to income inequality? What are your questions for our guest today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today. Chuck, you've been doing this work, addressing income inequality, for decades. People might be surprised to discover that you were, as the title of your book reveals, born on third base. You come from a family of great wealth, and you were set to inherit a very comfortable life. How did you end up where you are today?
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer. My first real job, actually, out of college, working here in New England, was with mobile home park tenants who were trying to buy their mobile home parks as cooperatives. And that gave me a window in the 1980s into how people were coping with the fact that real wages were sort of flattening out and even falling. And yet, I had came from this wealthy family. I grew up in the 1%. My great-grandfather was the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So we have a lot of jingles and jokes in our family about that. But I was at the same time watching the wealth that had been put in my name double every couple of years. So I sort of had this intimate front row seat to the inequalities that we're talking about, not just income, but wealth and assets. And I think that was that's what kind of made this a very personal issue for me and ultimately the decision I made to give the money to some foundations in New England.
You gave up your inheritance when you were in your 20s.
Yeah, and now I have children in my 20s who I tell them not to make any big decisions because their brains are still developing. But, it seemed like it was the right thing. I have no regrets. What it really allowed me to do was unflinchingly look at this picture of what's happened over the last 3 decades and kind of deepen my resolve to address the drivers of inequality.
One of the big statistics that's being discussed today is the statistics from the big Oxfam report that came out earlier this month that states that there are 8 men in the world who own as much as half of the population of the world. It is a shocking statistic, but I know it's only one way to measure the wealth gap or the income gap. What is a measure that you use to show the audiences that you talk to how wide it is and how it's widening over the decades?
Well, we did the sort of U.S. Corollary to that report. And what we found was that the Forbes 400 have as much wealth as the bottom 62% of the population, and the richest 20, enough that could fit in a sort of luxury 650 Gulfstream private jet, have as much wealth as the bottom half. And I think all these statistics are powerful because there's one other troubling trend, which is the number of households with zero or negative net worth is creeping up. So those are the two pieces of the story I think we have to understand.
And Robin, what do we see here in Maine? We don't have many people on the list of 400. How does the wealth gap play out here?
That's a good question. And thanks for having me on. Maine, you're right. Maine, it looks a little different. It might look like we have a less disparity in terms of income inequality, and that's really because we don't have as much wealth here in Maine. So our top 1%, for example, it makes about 15 times more than the bottom 99%. But if you look at the top 1%, on average, they're making about $612,000 a year. Compare that to a state like Massachusetts, where the top 1% is making about $1.7 million a year. So we don't have the wealth that you'd see in other places, but we certainly have income inequality. And there are some startling statistics in terms of poverty that we see here in Maine, and we see those growing worse.
One thing that's really interesting to me, Chuck, when you in your book that I was lucky enough to get to read over the weekend, when you talk about inherited wealth, you aren't just talking about these super rich people with trust funds and investment portfolios and perhaps private jets. You are talking about, as one of the engines of this, parents who are able to give their kids piano lessons or help them buy their first home. And that may come as a surprise to people that is contributing to the wealth gap. Explain your findings.
Yeah, I mean, one of the dynamics of these inequalities is, let's say, look at the top 10% of income and wealth households. Those households do everything they can to create opportunity, create enrichment experiences, invest in their kids, and give them a head start and a leg up. That's kind of what parents do. But in this case, they have so much more resources that those kids are kind of delinking from the rest of society. And now because we're not investing in early childhood education the way we should, or creating the ladder of opportunities for the bottom 90%, those what sociologists call the intergenerational transmission of advantage, parents helping their kids, not just big inheritances, but 101 small little things that propel them forward. And I argue that that sort of compounds advantage for people at the top, whereas everybody else is seeing accumulating or compounding disadvantage.
Are we seeing that? Are we seeing that, Robin, in Maine? Are we seeing a group of people that are not able to get any traction no matter what?
There's no question that we see that. And we see, that hard work alone doesn't cut it. You know, here in Maine, I think we pride ourselves on being hardworking. And we are. We're gritty. We're Mainers. But hard work alone isn't necessarily going to lead to financial success. And that the family you're born into really means a lot in terms of the opportunity you can access. Chuck also writes in his book about this idea about, if you have a family that's wealthy, they provide some adversity insurance, as he puts it. And I think that's a good point, too, in that, for people who do have resources, if you fall on hard times, if your car breaks down, if you have a health issue, you have a network, you have a family, you have people you can rely on to get you through that difficult time. But there are a lot of people here in Maine who don't have kind of that backup insurance policy when life brings you a tough blow. And we all kind of go through those tough times.
Chuck, is it worse than it has been, or does it just feel as though it's worse than it has been because we're living through it and we're not reading about it in a history book?
It is worse. In the 40 years after World War II, 1945 to the late 70s, really, we were a rising tide lifting almost all boats society. The bottom fifth saw their real incomes double. The top fifth also saw their incomes double. But in the last 35 years, we're seeing the top just pull away like they're on a rocket launcher. And real wages for almost half the population have pretty much stayed flat or fallen. So that's why all these things, and Robin is exactly right, this those inequalities are not a reflection of effort, deservedness, and hard work, as much as we sometimes kind of simplistically think that. These are distortions in the rules of the economy, where the rules have benefit asset owners. So people in my situation, born on third base, it's like incumbency protection. We once you become wealthy, there's a whole sort of wealth defense industry, if you will, that sort of kicks in to defend and expand your wealth and make sure that the rules of the economy benefit you. We're going to reduce capital gains taxes. We're going to cut estate and inheritance taxes. We're going to, you know, do things that keep your wealth growing. And everybody else isn't benefiting from that. So I think it's important to realize these are reflections of rules of the economy that have compounded these inequalities.
What about people, say, one of the examples you gave was the capital gains tax. Somebody might be listening to this and saying, I believe we need to cut the capital gains tax because we need to encourage spending. These are policies that were put in place to, encourage saving. What's wrong with that?
Well, I guess I'm in favor of taxing all income progressively, whether it comes from work or savings income. And the reason for that is it creates distortions. Why are we valuing income from assets, preferencing it over income from work? We can encourage people to save by reducing income taxes or reducing the most regressive taxes like local sales taxes and encouraging other forms of taxes. So what we're doing when we pick capital gains is we're really just benefiting the people in the, mostly benefiting people in the top 10% where, you know, the lion's share of capital gains comes from.
You said, go ahead, Robin.
Oh, I was just going to add to, you know, just to build on that, that there's a lot that we can do to create an economy where everybody gets a fair shot at a quality life. And, you know, at Maine Equal Justice, we're always working to, you know, Chuck talks about in his book, he talks about needing to raise the floor and level the playing field. And so we're working to raise the floor, believing that everyone should have access to basic income, to health, to opportunity here in Maine. And there are things we can do to raise that floor. You know, voters just elected to raise the minimum wage. So that's a step in the right direction. But there's much more we could do that would help to level the playing field for people by providing affordable health care, education, nutrition and family well-being. Some key things we could do that would definitely work to level the playing field and create more opportunity for more Mainers.
Chuck, you just said that in the period after World War II, we saw we saw the rising tide indeed raise all boats or many boats. We should be clear. What is different now than then? What was available then that is not available now? That was able to help folks in the bottom couple quartiles of the demographic tables?
Well, you know, in that period, 1945 to 1975, say, we had a very progressive federal tax system. We taxed high incomes at very progressive high rates. We taxed inheritances at progressive rates. And we invested in things that built a broader middle class, primarily for people of white, you know, European heritage. But things like a debt-free college education, not just the GI Bill, but through the public university systems, people could go to college, get a degree, pay for it by working a summer job painting houses. So the cost of education and millions of households were put on the wealth-building train thanks to first-time homebuyer programs. I have a friend in Maine whose dad got a farmer's home, 1%, 40-year fixed-rate mortgage in the 50s. You know, so that's what propelled and enabled her family to get on the wealth-building train. So we did things consciously focused on broadening the middle class. And we've kind of reversed that. We have reduced the progressivity of the federal tax system. We've cut taxes on high incomes, cut taxes on the wealthy. And we've also shifted the cost of education and the burdens of first-time homebuyers onto low- and middle-income people. Who don't have the same tools. We also invested a lot in infrastructure that helped create good-paying jobs. So those were that's one of the big differences. We've kind of reversed the formula that, as Robin said, raised the floor and helped expand opportunity for low- and middle-income people.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Robin, Chuck has talked about how nationally the statistics show that the wealth gap is widening and dramatically. So is that the case in Maine, or in Maine have we always sort of been, you know, on the edge of the American economy and the huge vicissitudes in it? And also, have we always pretty much been a hardscrabble state?
I think as far back as I can remember, we've always been a hardscrabble state. We have seen growing income inequality here. And as I mentioned before, we don't see the wealth here in Maine that we see in other parts of the country. But there's still a big divide. There's no doubt about it. And another trend we see that's very troubling here in Maine is around child poverty, where we've seen, you know, over the last 5 years, kids living in deep child poverty. So these are kids, a family of three making less than $10,000 a year. So the percentage of kids living in deep child poverty here in Maine has increased here in Maine 5 times faster than it has in the rest of the nation. And so that's a disturbing, you know, piece of data that I think we all need to pay attention to. And we see extreme poverty, especially in certain parts of the state, where in, you know, Piscataquis County, for example, almost 1 in 3 kids is growing up in poverty. In Washington County, it's nearly 1 in 4.
Are these numbers related to the changes in policies that Chuck Collins is talking about, or are these because the mills have shut down?
Well, there are a number of factors that contribute to this, and certainly the changing workforce does. There's no doubt in terms of, you know, there's less opportunity available to people. But we've also seen a lot of changes in policies here in Maine over the last 5-6 years that have limited people's access to supports that help to level the playing field. So we've seen over 40,000 people lose access to health insurance, for example. We've seen a lot of people, families, lose support meeting basic needs and food assistance. So there's certainly a correlation there in terms of the trend that we're seeing in the data. And also just what we hear from people every day who are experiencing just extreme hardship and trying to make ends meet.
All right. Well, we want to hear some solutions, and we'll hear from an economist after our break. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
On the next Fresh Air, a doctor's perspective on how medicine has changed the end of life.
Doing things has become very easy. Ordering a CT scan, ordering some treatment, but knowing when to stop is so much harder.
We talk with Dr. Heider Vorreich. His new book is called Modern Death. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. We all know nothing stays the same, and unfortunately, sometimes that even includes the voices and programs we're all used to on public radio, especially when hosts retire or programs are no longer being produced or distributed. Garrison Keillor, Diane Rehm, and David Dye have retired. The Best of Car Talk will end production later this year. And we've just recently learned the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean is also being discontinued in February. To accommodate, starting in February, a few new programs are joining our weekend lineup. Fresh Air Weekend, Freakonomics, Selected Shorts, and On the Media. Check out the new weekend Maine Public Radio schedule in Experience Magazine or at mainepublic.org and click on radio. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what can be done about the problems caused by income inequality? With me in the studio, Robin Merrill, who's an executive director, the executive director with the Maine Equal Justice Partners, and Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of Born on Third Base, a book about tackling inequality. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now, John Fitzgerald, a professor of economics at Bowdoin College. John, I know you've been listening to this conversation. What would you add to the conversation about the root causes of what we see today, the wealth gap, the income inequality?
Yes, thank you for having me on, Jennifer. I think Chuck kind of hit the nail on the head that the median wages have stagnated over time, and we do see the top pulling away. There's been a number of studies that have tried to determine what caused that, and I think there's multiple causes, but we can kind of think over that time period of the last few decades. Globalization occurred, a lot of increase in trade, increase in technology, and both of those things create winners and losers, where if you're a low education worker, those things may cost you your job or at least keep your wages down. If your high education can work with the technology, maybe it helps you. The other things that Robin mentioned as well, the minimum wage and institutions, the decline of labor unions, I think all of those things have worked to kind of stagnate working persons' wages compared to the high education group.
So it's not one factor, but a combination of factors. If we were to have this conversation, Professor, with three economists in the room, would there be agreement on the root causes of income inequality, or would there be debate?
I think there would be general agreement about the causes. I think the amount for each cause might be debated. There's some that think that trade has been the biggest mover in terms of holding wages down in the middle or for low education group. Some think technology. But the list of causes is probably pretty well agreed upon.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's more a matter of emphasis. The difficulty is both trade technology kind of have the same solutions or lack of solutions, which is trying to figure out how we increase productivity so that people can get higher wages.
And that was going to be my question. Chuck, I want to bring you into this conversation with John Fitzgerald, and I want to ask you, what are solutions that you turn to? You would like to see a change in our thinking about the estate tax.
Well, I just agree with Professor Fitzgerald that there's a number of reasons why this is happening, but I would point to the countries like the Canada and the Scandinavian countries that have lived through the same sort of globalization forces and technology forces, but have made decisions to not have inequality grow at the levels it has in the United States. I think part of that is what Robin said, raising the floor, things that sort of raise the minimum wage, keep people from falling below the sort of social safety nets. But it also has to do with the concentration of wealth and addressing that. So the estate tax is one of those things. It's a tax on inherited wealth at a very high level. And we're talking about households with wealth over $11 million today. That's when the estate tax starts. So I think we want to raise the floor, level the playing field, but we will lose ground if we don't address the distorting effects of this concentration of wealth at the top. And this is where it's, you know, politically unpopular, because people say, well, this is redistribution. But that's effectively what in U.S. history we've done to protect democracy and protect sort of investments in equal opportunity. And that if you allow these, as the French economist Thomas Piketty says, if we just don't intervene in the current situation, we're moving toward a hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power. So that's the danger, is if we don't intervene on these great concentrations of wealth.
Professor Fitzgerald, do you agree?
I think, yes. One of the results of the inequality, I think, is there's an inequality in political power that's occurring that allows people to kind of rewrite the rules. And some of the tax cuts for the top end, trying to eliminate the estate tax, I think those are attempts to redistribute political power in a way that brings economic power. So I agree completely. Things like keeping the estate tax and strengthening tax on capital gains would be worthwhile. We do need to also try to increase education levels, encourage firms to invest so that productivity goes up for workers. There are just as there are multiple causes, I think there's multiple points of attack.
This is Robin. When I think of, you know, just to add on to increasing people's education levels and thinking of solutions, I think of a young woman, Samantha, who contacted us a while back, who is, you know, raising a 2-year-old daughter on her own. And she contacted us because she wanted to continue her education, seeing, you know, education as a real pathway out of poverty. And so we worked with her to access. There are programs that can help, you know, low-wage working parents go back to school and support them to get higher education. The Parents of Scholars program, Samantha got enrolled, is now working to become a nurse, is doing an excellent job. And, you know, not only will this answer, like, poverty for her, you know, she's going to make life better for herself, better for her 2-year-old daughter, Audrey. But also, this is what Maine needs, you know, in terms of really investing. We see a shortage of skilled workers here in Maine, and nurses, you know, that's definitely an area where there's high demand. So it answers kind of the problems for the individuals, the families, but also it's a solution really for our state.
Mm-hmm. Professor Fitzgerald, thanks for calling in and joining us today. We're going to move on to some other calls. We're going to start with Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, one of the questions I had wanted to see addressed a little bit was not so much about the larger issue, but pay as opposed to wealth, and how we value the various jobs that we now have in society, because it doesn't seem very well tied to their value to society right now. Because if you're handling money, for instance, you're worth a whole lot more somehow than if you're, you know, coming to fix my plumbing. And plumbers are not badly paid, but, you know, the big money managers, they're making a whole lot of money, and they are not, in the strictest sense, productive. You know, I mean, this to me, this seems like the ongoing class warfare that has, you know, that seems to be the history of humanity. And we might have made a try at controlling it in the 50s a little bit, with some success, I think. But, you know, you try that now and you're called a socialist or a communist or, you know, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, well, and I think at the end there, Mike, a really interesting point that there is name calling that goes on. And Chuck, you talk about this in your book, that if we're using phrases like calling people socialists, that's not good. But also if you use phrases such as soak the rich, that's maybe not helpful either.
Well, I think Mike is tuned in, and I think people are understandably upset, angry, you know, at people who are wealthy for just what Mike described. There's sort of this weird class bias in how we value different kinds of work and how people in the financial sectors, certainly in the last 20, 30 years, their efforts have been so overly rewarded compared to other very valuable occupations in the society. So I totally appreciate that. And part of what I try to do in Born on Third Base, and just when I talk to people who are in the top 1% or the top 10%, is say, look, these inequalities are not good for anybody. They're not good for economic health. They're not good for the kind of world we want to live in. We're heading toward a sort of an economic apartheid society. And that's actually going to be bad for growth and bad for economic activity. So I think my message is, one percenters or people who are wealthy, these inequalities matter to not just people who are poor. These will destroy or undermine the quality of life for everybody. So that's why everybody needs to step up. So that's where it's less of a class antagonistic thing, because I'm basically saying these class dynamics are tearing our society apart.
We'll go to Larry, who posts on Facebook, what about prison labor in the Mid-Coast? You see prisoners work for $10 an hour and the regular employees making 16 to 20, but it stagnates wages and takes jobs while lining the pockets of the companies. Is this an issue you've looked at, Robin?
I haven't looked specifically at this issue, no.
Okay. A related one, Chuck, would be, though, internships, right?
Unpaid internships.
And, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that there are ways in which affluent families, one of the great examples of, you know, if you have parents with resources, you can do the summer internship in the area of your study and where you want to get a job. But if you have to pay off these enormous amounts of student debt, which are just outrageous and not good for anybody, then you have to work, and you can't necessarily do that unpaid internship. And that's just another little example of how these sort of inequalities open up. So, you know, more and more companies want young workers to show up with the work experience in their field. And how do you get that work experience if you have to worry about paying back a student loan? So that's just another example of compounding advantage.
We'll go to Stephen, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. My favorite speaker on inequality is Robert Reich. He's on Facebook. His group is Inequality Media. He's former Labor Secretary. He's very informative, and he knows what he's talking about. So I urge people to look him up on Facebook and listen to what he's got to say. It's very informative.
Thank you, Stephen. We'll move on to Presque Isle and Matthew. Hi, Matthew. Go ahead. Matthew,
Hi,
are you there?
Yeah. I was thinking about income equality among people, and then I was thinking how corporations are legally have the responsibility and rights of people, but they don't actually have the desire to make anything ethically. They don't have the desire to enact that social responsibility. And I think it's time for us to start revoking a couple corporate charters of the ones that really don't do society any good at all.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. Chuck?
Important point. Corporation, the sort of public intent or social good intent of many corporate charters has been lost. And one interesting thing is you see a lot of states creating a new type of corporate charter, what they call kind of a Chapter B corporation, with the idea that you sort of have a different set of accountabilities. You are not only just accountable to your shareholders, you're accountable to the community where you reside, to your workers and other stakeholders. And so they're creating new corporate charters. And I believe in Maine that's what's happening as well. So it's possible to say, let's redefine what a corporation stands for and how they operate.
We have an email from Marie. A big reason why wages have fallen is the dearth of unions. It's harder to join a union, and there are more right-to-work states. And I think both of you, Robin and Chuck, would agree with that. But I want to throw something that's related out there, which is, you know, there are more and more right-to-work states because there is more and more support for this idea. You know, why are we as voters in the United States making these decisions that Marie in the email would say is bad for wages? Chuck, I'm guessing you would agree it's bad for wages, yet more and more states are choosing this.
I think what's happened is, you know, in the years when we really grew together after World War II, 35% of the workforce was in a union. What's happened is that as wages have fallen in the private sector, public employee unions have tried to hold on to a decent standard of living, and yet that little resentment keeps getting rubbed. You know, oh, private sector wages are going down and the public sector is holding ground. My view is we should be trying to get more private sector jobs to have the same benefits and quality and compensation as public sector jobs. The answer is not to keep dismantling what remaining good jobs are there. But I think some politicians have been very good at pitting workers against each other to abandon union protections. So, you know, I mean, Maine has a great tradition of unionization in, you know, the paper workers and other sectors that not only benefited those employees, but actually lifted up the standard of living for everybody. And if we keep sort of pointing our finger at workers who have a decent deal, we're going to just keep pulling the supports out from the rest of us. So it's the old principle of solidarity is kind of missing in this current political moment.
And we've certainly seen that in recent years here in Maine from some politicians where groups are being pitted against one another. And so instead of promoting policies that really unite us, bring us together, we're seeing policies proposed that take help away from some groups. And we're seeing a lot of rhetoric that really pits groups against one another, groups that are less powerful. We can't help this group because this needs to go to this more deserving group. When the reality is that we can ensure opportunity and basic needs for every Mainer.
We do have to take another short break. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Goodwill of Northern New England, serving communities so nothing goes to waste. Not a shirt, not a shoe, not a person. Learn more at goodwillnne.org. And the law firm of Eaton Peabody, statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland. If you're in Portland or surrounding communities and like classical music, give 104.1 FM another try. Our Portland area Maine Public Classical Station has been tweaked in a good way, making the signal a bit stronger and go a bit further. This means if you are in Portland and the surrounding communities, you may now find that 104.1 FM brings you the classical music you want. Listening to Maine Public Classical by online streaming has also improved. You can stream Maine Public Classical live at mainepublic.org on your desktop, tablets, or Apple or Android devices, and listen to a new, higher-quality stereo stream. Enjoy. Coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, Commonwealth Club of California. Obamacare architect and health policy expert Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel discusses the impetus for delivery reform during the Trump era. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Addressing Income Inequality. Joining me today, Chuck Collins with the Institute for Policy Studies. His new book is Born on Third Base, and it's on the topic of addressing income inequality, and Robin Merrill, who is with Maine Equal Justice Partners. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Lake. She says, or he says, the post-war growth of the middle class was largely created by pressure from working class movements and parties whose names have since been invalidated in the American political culture. The suspicion of words like socialism leads many working people to fear that organizing to fight for their own rights and wages will conjure totalitarianism and pro-capitalist propaganda tends to bolster this fear. Hence, working people whose interests would have been served by Bernie Sanders chose to ignore him. Could you please talk about the role language plays in inhibiting the organization of people who are losing the economic game? Robin, would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think that was really well put in terms of making the point that language can play a big part in that. And it already came up in this discussion in terms of name-calling and using that as a way to diminish certain points of view. We definitely see that. We see that here in Maine.
All right. We'll go to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I think another option is to look at, in terms of addressing inequality, is to look at how much people are paid. I think a lot of people beyond the median income are paid too much for what they're doing.
Larry, would you advocate legislating pay limitations?
Well, I'm just putting out the idea because it's not one that very many people think of. I mean, basically, people who are paid a lot of money get a lot of other benefits as well. They, you know, think they have jobs are less boring. They get a lot more respect and recognition. They have a lot more freedom. They have job security. We shouldn't be giving them a lot more money at the same time.
Okay, and, Chuck, I'm going to let Chuck respond.
Well, one important point that underlying Larry's question is we as taxpayers sort of subsidize excessive compensation in some companies. So I'm starting to see the other Portland, Oregon, just passed an interesting ordinance. They call it the pay gap penalty. But it's basically they're saying companies and businesses that have a compensation gap, you know, over 50 to 1 actually have to pay a little higher surcharge so that we don't end up subsidizing excessive pay gaps. So that's a very interesting example. And whereas I don't think you can actually legislate a cap, you could say, the rest of us shouldn't have to subsidize it.
We'll move on to Marie, who's calling from Central Maine. Hi, Marie. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to just make a couple of points. First, regarding what Chuck said regarding the estate tax, for full disclosure, he had just mentioned that households who have $11 million, that's when the estate tax kicks in. But if it's an individual, just one person, it's $5.5 million. But the main thing, reason that I'm calling is that, to me, in terms of Maine, one of the underlying issues that I see is that in Maine, we people who have money are not willing to admit that they have money, and they don't want their neighbors to know that.
Okay, so Marie, I'm going to cut you off because your connection is bad, but I think I heard you well enough. And Chuck, this is something you talk about in your book, is one, how people talk about their wealth, but also what they admit to themselves.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we can talk about how what holds these inequalities in place, but some of what holds it in place is the stories we tell ourselves that justify these inequalities, the sort of myths of deservedness. And my experience is it's very important for people who have advantage to tell true stories about what help they got, whether it was public subsidies like that farmer's home loan that helped you get on the wealth building train, or inheritances. The sort of mystification of class kind of makes it seem like, well, hey, I'm just doing just fine. What's the matter with everyone else? And I think that if people can be more honest and open and without shame, just talking about this is how advantage works in our society, I think it would help demystify the whole thing for so many people. And we're so wound up when it comes to talking about issues of class. I encourage people to check out, there's a little group called classism.org, which is a website that just has tools for real having conversations about class, which is what the invisibility perpetuates.
Marie, thank you.
And, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Alice, who's calling from Richmond. Hi, Alice.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the program, and I agree with everything everybody's saying. My take on that I would suggest is that, speaking to solidarity, is there's a dearth of solidarity on a lot of the approaches to trying to solve some of these problems. And I give the example of the Maine Care expansion referendum, which is so frustrating to me, because there are many, many, many more people who are left uninsured with unaffordable, you know, coverage under the Affordable Care Act, who are ignored by, you know, folks who are constantly promoting the Maine Care expansion, and I see that there's a backlash. You know, I blame the Democrats for LePage's election because we've built a system of supports that addresses simply a subset of need, which leaves lower middle class people paying taxes and getting no benefit, and they see people around them who are getting benefits. For example, the education, you know, the woman who's getting supports to get her nursing degree, that's fantastic. But why don't we have a system where once you've achieved that, there's a repayment into a revolving fund, and everybody has access to that, so you don't set up a dynamic where, you know, one person has had supports, gets their nursing degree, doesn't pay anything back, and somebody who was right above the line for the subsidies is paying, you know, significant student loans. And why don't we, you know, why don't we have a referendum for true universal single-payer health care instead of once again ignoring the middle class? Speaking of Washington County, if you were
Alice, I'm gonna stop you right now. But this idea of Robin, of building resentment, we do see a lot of this in Maine, and it is a barrier to creating. I'm asking, posing this as a question, is it a barrier to creating conversations that lead to meaningful solutions?
I think it can be a barrier, as I talked about before, kind of this pitting of groups against one another. And ultimately, we need solutions that are going to work for everybody. And, you know, we need affordable health care for everyone. You know, and the caller brings up the Medicaid expansion referendum. That's one step, but that's working within the system that we're working within. We need to do more than that. We need to ensure that everybody has access to affordable health care. And so I think that's a good point, is that the system is sometimes structured so that it does create these divides between people. And as much as we can break that down and really make sure that everybody is able to meet their basic needs so we can raise the floor. That's going to benefit all of us.
And Chuck, you talk about this in your book, maybe not using the term resentment, but you've talked about your own evolution and how you think about the wealth gap and the wealthy and the poor in America.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we know is that during times of growing inequality and rising economic insecurity, which is what, you know, half of people in Maine are experiencing, there's both a progressive populism, which is sort of like the Bernie Sanders focus on the concentrations of wealth, but you also have a regressive populism or a politics of resentment, a deflection onto low and middle-income people or immigrants, et cetera. And that's what we're living with, and that was true 100 years ago during the last time we were as unequal as we are. We had the rise of the Klan and nativism, but we also had the rise of progressive rural populism. So, that resentment deflection stuff is the oldest story in the book, really. And that's what, you know, I think as Robin says, we have to sort of – when people are encouraged to blame somebody who has less power than you, hold on to your wallet – because somebody is trying to focus your attention away from the real causes of the inequalities we're dealing with.
I want to bring up a couple of phrases that we hear a lot in American political culture today that would be, counter to where you all are coming from. One of them is, we can't do things that somehow harm or rein in the job creators, the phrase the job creators, that we're creating policy based on being able to enable the quote-unquote job creators to create jobs. Chuck, how does that square with how you look at the widening income gap?
Well, you often hear people talk about the wealthy as if having wealth inherently makes you a job creator. And a number of our, the sort of patriotic millionaires network, a big part of what we try to do is debunk that. It's a healthy economy has a growing middle class, has a floor that's rising so more people can participate as consumers and spenders and investors. And it's the concentrated wealth. Wealthy people, sometimes are investing in productive investments, but there's a huge amount of wealth that's going into the sort of speculative financial casino that's actually not creating anything of value and is destabilizing the economy. So I would just remember that we're all job creators, and particularly workers and consumers who are participating in the economy probably create more jobs than all the sort of speculative investment of the 1%.
And Rob, go ahead.
I would just add, the key to long-term economic growth here in Maine is really investing in the foundations of our communities, like good schools, good roads, quality health care. And by bolstering Maine's foundation, Maine's people and our economy can thrive. And that's going to benefit job creators. It's going to benefit employers. It's going to benefit all of us if we make those investments.
And the other phrase is one we touched on a little bit earlier, Robin, which is pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, not looking for a government handout. That is really, really deeply entrenched in how many, if not most, people in America think.
So that's that. Yeah. And that's, I think Chuck's book does a great job at really exposing the myth of the self-made man or woman in terms of, nobody makes it on their own in this world. We all get help along the way in some form or fashion. And people are born with opportunities, and some people are born with a lot more opportunity at the outset. And all of us get some form of subsidy, some form of help along the way. I think about my family has benefited from the mortgage interest deduction in recent years since becoming a homeowner. I got a subsidy from the federal government in terms of financial aid when I went to college. We all get help along the way. We're all going to get older. We're all going to face, health issues later in life or earlier than that. And so this idea that I just come back to decent families and societies do that for one another. We help one another, and there shouldn't be anything wrong with that.
Okay, I think I can squeeze in one more call. I'm going to go to Tracy calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks. I actually grew up in Pittsburgh in the 70s and 80s, and at a time when an entire industry shut down. And I've been in Maine for 9 years. And the thing that is I feel is so different this time around with economic transformation that's been happening is it back then we had all kinds of programs. DARPA invested money in helping local businesses, and we had things called economic development districts where, you know, a struggling area would get some help. And now it just seems like we don't have that kind of government involvement in saying, hey, there's been some economic degradation here. What do we need to do to help this area get back on its feet? And I don't know if that's part, you know, part of it is that, you know, there's just no, there's, we're so divided and there's no support for that kind of activity on the part of government. I also think about, you know, I was reading Hidden Figures when Sputnik happened, you know, there was a huge focus on getting people into new job training and new educational opportunities so they could improve their skills and be relevant in the economy. And so why can't we do that today?
All right, Chuck?
Well, I think it ultimately comes down to money. We've basically are starving lots of localities, and it starts at the top. It starts at the federal level. We've been cutting taxes that used to be invested in states, that used to be invested in localities, that helped regions manage the transitions that you described, Tracy. You know, I think, and that's where the conversation gets tricky. I mean, I think people in Maine should be very proud that when you've gone to the voters, as you did in November, you raised your state minimum wage. You talked about a surtax on high incomes to invest in early childhood education. That is exactly what our states, localities, and the national government should be doing. We should be investing in the public goods that create opportunity. Robin was way more eloquent than I am. She just, you know, this is what good societies do, is you help manage transitions. You don't just say, you are all on your own, good luck. And so we have to change the culture. And I think people in Maine have shown that if they're given the direct opportunity to do that, they want to live in a society where everybody has an opportunity. And I think there are a lot of wealthy people who, if they're not already engaged in growing inequality in Maine, making Maine one of the more equal states in our country, they should be engaged and brought to the table and said, this is in your direct self-interest.
Thank you both for joining me today. Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. He's the author of Born on the Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing for the common good. And Robin Merrill is the executive director of Maine Equal Justice Partners. Nikki Shields ran the board today. There will be no repeat of the show this evening, but you can find us online anytime at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a discussion about the major news of the past month here in Maine and on the national front. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.